when you think of your context, when you hear about missions, as you go to a talk about evangelism or church planning or worship that helps people know the Lord, when you pray for people, when you think about what the gospel means, what the gospel is, what the gospel entails, what the gospel provokes us to do and to think, I'm sure you have a particular context in mind. And I know you do, because otherwise it would be just meaningless, right? For it to actually have meaning, for us to actually think about something, we have to give it a concrete world to live in. And that's what we mean when we talk about context, right? So I'm going to start our discussion with this launching pad, I guess, at Andrew Walls. He's a missiologist, a longtime missiologist, talks about in this essay called The Gospel as a Prisoner and Liberator of Culture. And this is from a long time ago. This is from 1981, so this is 30-plus years ago. Missiologists are great. Anthropologists are great as well. Sociologists are great in thinking about context and thinking about our awareness of our own context as well as awareness of other people's contexts. And in this essay, Andrew Walls talks about a spaceman or spaceman, whichever, but the spaceman, he's saying, well, the spaceman comes to Earth, and he or she or it visits several different places and times in the world. So the first place he visits, or we'll just say he for now, is spaceman. So the first place the spaceman visits is Jerusalem, and he visits Jerusalem Christians around 37 AD. And he sees that everyone's Jewish. He sees that they meet in the temple. The Jews can enter. He sees that they circumcise their male children. They carefully follow certain rituals. They read old books of the law, Torah. And then he takes off from there. And then his next visit to our earth is in 325. At a meeting of church leaders called the Council of Nicaea. And he sees there that they're from all over the Mediterranean, but almost no one is Jewish. And they don't actually have a lot of children, because those church leaders are committed to celibacy. They use the Torah differently. They have it in a different translation. They address each other differently. They talk about the Lord a little bit. They talk about their Lord a little bit differently. Okay, so and then the spaceman leaves, and their concerns are different and all that, right? So the spaceman leaves, and he comes back again, and he visits London in the 1840s, and he goes to a missions conference about missions to Africa, in London in the 1840s. And this spaceman is saying everyone has a Bible. And there's a lot of written material, pamphlets and articles and books. And he sees, oh, there's this connection to this Council of Nicaea. They accept this creed that council had established. They use certain vocabulary a lot. They have a certain view of other people, including people in Africa. So his next visit, very conveniently, is to Africa, to Nigeria, in 1980. And he goes to this church that exists in 1980 in Nigeria, and he sees, wow, this looks very different. They're dressed differently. They move differently. They dance and chant on the streets on their way to their worship. They talk about God differently. They talk about different things. Well, they have the same book, but they kind of talk about different things. There are different issues that they seem to care about. And so this is a really nice, kind of fictional, but interesting entryway into thoughts about contextualization. So he talks about these two principles, which we'll get into in a second, but an indigenizing principle and a pilgrim principle. And the idea is that the indigenizing principle is always at work, And that's a principle that makes the gospel very particular to a certain group of people. And then there's another principle at work called the pilgrim principle, and that's a universalizing principle. And that's what joins Christians from all times and places together. So when we think about the spaceman's travels, we could think, okay, he visited four different places, and there is some commonality between those four places. And that's the pilgrim principle at work. At the same time, the spaceman sees, oh, they're all pretty different, actually. I mean, they're sort of similar, but they're all pretty different. And that's the indigenizing principle at work. And Walz's point is, they're both at work constantly. And we need to be aware of both. And we actually have to get the balance right, because there's a problem when there's too much indigenization without that pilgrim principle at work, and vice versa. Getting back to the indigenizing principle and the pilgrim principles, let's remember as we go forward that both of these are at work. So we're not choosing between one or the other. Okay? Both of these principles are at work constantly, and we have to take both very seriously. We have to remember when we look back at our pilgrim history, that is our shared common history, we can think of our heroic church fathers who refuted Gnostic heresy. And when we think of those church fathers, we have to remember that they were just as Greek as the Gnostics. Okay, it's not that they like occupied completely different worlds, or that the Gnostic worldview was so foreign to the early church fathers. I mean, they shared the same air. They shared many of the same presuppositions. They shared many of the same concerns. They shared many of the same difficulties and challenges in understanding the gospel. And this kind of group of heroic church fathers who defeated Gnostic heresy were not just Christian pilgrims, but they were Greek pilgrims. They were Greek Christians, just as Greek as their neighbors. And so for us, when we think about an indigenizing principle, this helps us avoid forcing kind of non-essential modes of thought or life or someone else's concerns and preoccupations onto others. And that's one benefit of keeping in mind this indigenizing principle. One benefit, we'll talk about more benefits, but another benefit that we find from the pilgrim principle is that it keeps us from giving up the gospel entirely, such that we're no different from our neighbors. So we can think of this in terms of the early church fathers in the first few centuries. We can think of it today. So for example, if you live in an American suburb, you are just as suburban as your neighbors. You drive the same cars. You, your kids are in the same activities. Your calendar looks awfully similar. The way you dress is pretty similar. What you read can often be very similar. The movies you watch, the music you listen to, the TV shows you watch, the culture you consume, very similar. At the same time, we have this principle at work in us, this pilgrim principle, not just an indigenizing principle, but a pilgrim principle at work in us, and it makes us very different from our suburban neighbors. That we actually are faced, perhaps weekly, perhaps daily, with this gospel that actually challenges our suburban existence, that makes us have fundamental questions about our value system that our neighbors are not facing. Okay, does that make sense? And so, of course, we're going to be different from our neighbors. And we're going to be more like some guy, Athanasius, that lived, you know, more than 1,000 years ago than we are to our neighbors. But in other ways, we're obviously going to be more like our non-Christian neighbors than we are to Athanasius. So that's what we're talking about, the pilgrim principle at work at the same time that an indigenizing principle is at work. And so we can talk about something as basic as the gospel. You know, this is a word that we throw around, the gospel, in other words, good news, the story of Jesus Christ, this good news of joy to us. That's like what the angel said, I give to you I evangelize to you joy. I bring you news of great joy to those shepherds. And when we talk about this gospel, I think there might be a tendency for us to think of the gospel in terms of purely a pagan principle without thinking about the indigenizing principle at work. So we think in our heads, oh, there must be sort of a pure acultural, that is without culture, like just pure, just living on its own gospel. And we think, okay, if we just need to get in touch with that pure gospel, and then, you know, we'll be really happy, we'll be effective in helping people know the Lord and all that. But I think when we think about how things really work, especially when we think about how big the world is, not just in our time, but over time, when we think about the spaceman's travels, when we think about even our own conversations just now, I think we're forced to consider, well, you know, there are principles at work. Yeah, there's a pilgrim principle, but there's also an indigenizing principle. And that is no less true of the gospel. And so when we think of the gospel, I think it's very difficult for us when we have this kind of conversation, it's very difficult for us to hold on to this idea that there's this pure gospel out there that's free of a particular form, that's free of style, that's free of a particular history, that's free of presuppositions. Does that make sense? But what we're trying to remember, especially as we have this kind of conversation, is that even the gospel has an indigenizing principle at work as well. Is there a pure, pure gospel? And I don't mean pure as in clean or good. Yes, we do have a really good and clean gospel. But when I say a pure gospel, I mean pure as in unadulterated, untouched, just on its own, completely free from culture. And I think the more realistic answer to that question is no. Okay, if it helps to get our mind around it, I want to just give a few analogous kind of examples. So one is, I'll just put out there, Hamlet. Okay, Hamlet, or another Shakespearean play, if you prefer, but we'll just go with Hamlet. You guys all know Hamlet? Or should we go Romeo and Juliet? Romeo and Juliet? Has anyone not seen or read Romeo and Juliet in some iteration? Okay, we'll just go with Romeo and Juliet. Okay, Romeo and Juliet. Is there such a thing as the Romeo and Juliet? Like a pure, unadulterated, culture-free, history-less, presuppositionless Romeo and Juliet?
No.
Okay, so let's talk about the Romeo and Juliet. Who has seen or read more than one, I guess it's scene. Let's go with scene. Who has seen more than one performance of Romeo and Juliet? Okay, so let's say you've seen, we'll just give it a round number, 10. Is that too many? Let's say four. Four performances of Romeo and Juliet. Movie, play, enacting it in your own house, I don't know, with your friends. So out of those four, if you think about those four, how is each one the same, and how is each one different? Well, I'll just answer the same part, because I think that's the most obvious. The script is the same. Okay, so assuming the script is the same, and the same author and whatnot, we have this kind of pilgrim principle at work in Romeo and Juliet. But what about what makes those performances different? Anyone?
Age of the people.
Age of the people? So, for example, could you make that more specific?
Yeah, different age. Some of them are talked about in the context of the people being older as the people being younger.
Okay, so how does that change Romeo and Juliet if it's a 75-year-old Romeo versus a 15-year-old Romeo?
It's a basic story, a love story and everything.
Okay. But how anyone else can jump in as well. So how is it different? How is the story sort of different, sort of the same, but sort of different when it's a 75-year-old Romeo versus
You're coming from a different context.
Okay.
Different lifestyle.
Okay. Okay. Anyone else? Any differences between
stage design?
Okay, yeah.
The live performance, the stage design, the set, that whole interpretation of
the
as well as the the, I'm trying to think, like it's film or live stage, that kind of thing, that has an impact.
The location.
75 of those, you'd have to change the whole family dynamic of the story. I mean, that story even works with West Side Story. But the family dynamic.
Yeah, so West Side Story is Romeo and Juliet. Definitely. The script is different,
But with 75-year-olds, you know, as the main characters, you'd have to figure out how to do the whole family. That'd be difficult to work that theme, right? Don't change.
Okay.
You know.
Right, right.
You can have street gangs and still have Romeo and Juliet told faithfully to the message.
Okay.
That's Shakespeare.
Language.
Language, yes, language.
I saw that in German.
Yes. Yeah. How does that change it when it's translated? Yeah.
Well, I can still see the whole story moving, but the language would change even different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Wes Arena.
Yeah, I was just thinking of even if you have, say, the young cast, and they have two nights of the performance in the same place, same set.
Yes.
Different audiences are going to be, that's a totally different experience because there's interaction.
Each night is different. Right?
The audience feeds off, the actors feed off the audience. You know,
that's
there's different energy level and all that.
That's right. Even if all of the same actors, same set.
They say everything really exactly the same. Same tone and everything, there's still
it's a different thing. Yeah, anyone else? Yeah.
Well, the interpretation, like the director will decide that he this is his interpretation,
yes.
He's going to slant it a certain way.
Yeah.
I saw an opera last summer that was just appalling, you know, because it was a Mozart opera that they had a woman being stoned and people in burkas and all this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you can just see how. Something, and of course you could do that with the Bible too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, someone could say this is what it means, and you know.
Yeah, if you hear it five different sermons.
There must be a pure interpretation of all these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
or right and wrong.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah.
Even an actor in a given line can change the context just by tone.
Mm-hmm.
Can guide an interpretation.
You can spin a meaning just by the inflection of the voice too. So even though the script is identical, you can adjust it with the tone.
So let me ask, what is Romeo and Juliet not Romeo and Juliet?
Yeah, that's a great question. Okay, that's a great question. We'll tackle that as a seminar at DuMont's.
Yeah,
that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great question. Okay, so having said that, then going back to our original question. Is it even possible, is it possible to have a cultureless, pure, like interpretationless Romeo and Juliet? I don't think so. And in the same way, can we say the same thing about the gospel? Is it possible to have a cultureless, an acultural, presupposition-free, culture-free gospel performance? Yeah, no. So we'll talk a little bit more about this. We'll take a 15 minute break.